The Dark Eclipse is a book of personal essays in which author A.W. Barnes seeks to come to terms with the suicide of his older brother Mike. Using source documentation, the police report, the autopsy, a suicide note, and a death certificate, the essays explore Barnes' relationship with Mike and their status as gay brothers raised in a large, conservative family in the Midwest. In addition, the narrative traces the brothers' difficult relationship with their father, a man who once studied to be a Trappist monk before marrying and fathering 8 children. Because of their shared sexual orientation, Andrew hoped he and Mike would be close, but their relationship was as fraught as the author's relationship with his own brothers and father. Again, the name of the book is The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Andy Barnes to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it as well.
What brought this process to you in the sense of the necessity, I assume, to write these essays in which you look to come to terms with the suicide of your older brother?
Yeah, you know, my older brother, Mike, committed suicide 25 years ago. And in that period of time, I've really tried to figure out a way to understand that suicide, why he did it, in the same way that many, many people who are affected by suicide, who have loved ones who have committed suicide or friends, try to understand why did this happen. And for me in particular, I also wanted to understand what does that mean for me? Mike and I were two gay brothers who grew up in a conservative family in the Midwest, and we had similar childhoods. And the real question for me is, why did I survive, and why didn't my brother survive that childhood?
You just said this, and I clutched onto it. And is it possible for you ever to fully understand what happened?
No, it isn't in a way. And what I've tried to do is to get as close as I possibly can. And the way I did this was by looking at documents surrounding his death. So his death certificate, the autopsy report, his suicide note, the police report, to try to glean as much information as I possibly could to get a sense of why he did this. So I can only ever sort of approximate why. But in the end, really the question became, what was it about me that allowed me to survive and to continue to survive? And maybe also, what is it that could help other people who perhaps have suicidal ideations survive?
When it comes to the things that you use within this book, of looking at the police report and the autopsy and the suicide note and the death certificate, how do they help you? And do they, were they an assistance in filling in blanks of what you didn't already know?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was, because I assumed I knew how my brother died. I assumed I knew sort of the circumstances around why he died, but those were only my assumptions. So when I went into these documents, I found that, oh, he had died in a hospital in a hotel in Times Square, and he had written a suicide note. And I kind of knew the method he used, but I wasn't for sure what that method was, and I found out through the autopsy. And also, he left behind a document called The Salient Facts of Patient Michael J. Barnes, which was a detailed record of the year before he died of the ailments he was experiencing. And this really also helped me to understand his mindset. Because in the end, he claims, and there's some question about this because my brother was a hypochondriac, that he was HIV positive. And that the reason he gave for killing himself was that he feared a dementia that often came with AIDS. So that helped me a little bit, but again, there are no final answers. There's no sort of complete conclusion to that question I have.
You write about this, and I think it is so interesting that you had a feeling that some of your family had forgotten about your brother.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's not true for my mother, obviously, but I come from a family of 7 boys and 1 girl. I'm the middle son. And for most of my family, they all live back in Indianapolis. I am the only one who lives outside of the family. My brother Mike also lived away from our hometown. And for my family, the most important thing is the raising of their children, raising family, and being together as family units. And Mike and I existed outside of that idea. And we were easily, and he was easily, kind of forgotten. And he still is kind of forgotten. His name is not mentioned that much anymore, 25 years later, when I go back home to visit my family.
You say that, and you alluded to this a moment ago, that because of your shared sexual orientation that you had hoped that you and your brother would be close. But right. it was a fraught relationship. Did any of this exploration help you in identifying the reasons for that?
Yes, and not only that, but since Mike's death, I also have gone on to, I have a PhD in English literature, and my focus has always been in all of my intellectual work is to understand the relationship between men, regardless of its father and son, and I talk about a lot of my relationship to my father in this book, whether it's brothers, whether it's just male friends. And those very key relationships between men are themselves fundamentally fraught. And just because my brother and I happened to be gay, that didn't override the fact that we were still brothers. And all the difficulties of being brothers came first, as it were, and sort of prevented us from being any closer than, at least in my family, our brothers could be.
And you were as close to him as you were to your other brothers and to your father.
That's exactly right, which means not so close.
Right.
I think that we both feared, as a lot of men do, that we both feared a kind of intimacy, a kind of emotional intimacy that kept us at a distance and keeps me at a distance from my father and from my other brothers as well.
Without getting overly psychological here, I do find it interesting, though. I'm the youngest of five boys, and mm-hmm. but my father was very loving and very demonstrative, and there was a lot of hugging and kissing on the cheek,
mm-hmm.
and so do you think it's a lot of that is handed down from the father?
I think it is, because my father was just the opposite of your father. My father, as I talk about in the book, studied to be a Trappist monk down in Kentucky, where Thomas Merton once was. And so he had a very monastic, stoic life or mindset. And I say that he may have left the monastery, but he did not leave monasticism. And so our family was really governed by this idea of being alone, of being by oneself, of being reserved, especially emotionally. So I think it is set, the tone of a family is set in many ways by the father, especially for boys. And my father happened to be quite emotionally, still is, a quite emotionally distant person.
And you said this, but I just want to clarify, but then none of your brothers had a close relationship with your father.
Not really. No, none of my brothers. My father is still alive, and we don't have that close of a relationship with him.
You would think often. I mean, I don't know. But how does something as traumatic as a suicide affect a family and have any impact in bringing a family unit together?
Ours did not. Ours had just quite the opposite effect, that Mike was easily forgotten because his suicide wasn't talked about. And I think that's one of the important things I want to get across in this book, that especially in this country where right now we are experiencing a suicidal epidemic, one of the key ways of preventing this is to talk about it, is to talk about suicide, to talk about one's feelings of suicide, which are quite common across America right now. But in our family, that did not happen. The suicide did not. In fact, it splintered us further apart. I think I say in the book, I know I say in the book, that there's a moment, a sort of very difficult moment, when my mother and father and I were identifying Mike's body at a morgue here in Manhattan, and my father had said to me, his other gay son, pointedly, anyone who lives this kind of life deserves to die this way. So for him, it was a moral imperative. And so it really, obviously, that statement put an emotional wedge between my father and I that I've been spending 25 years trying to reconcile.
Do you erupt at the moment?
How do you mean?
That could be one of the most devastating things that anybody could say to another person. So I'm curious of, did you erupt? Did you react at that moment?
No, I didn't, because it was totally expected. This is something that I knew my father believed in. My father did not want gay sons. If you had asked him today, he still would not want gay sons. So he was quite hostile to our being gay. And so it was something that was completely expected of him. He was also a person whose morals and whose religious belief trumped everything else. So I often tell the story that, the story of Abraham and Isaac in the Bible, that Abraham's supposed to sacrifice Isaac, but God stops him. In my father's case, he would not have stopped had God said so. He would have been more than willing to sacrifice his sons.
A.W. Barnes is our guest. The name of the new book is The Dark Eclipse, Reflections on Suicide and Absence. You do make the differentiation between suicide and absence, of course, and those are two very different things to deal with for you.
That's right. I think that the initial violent act of suicide is something that affected me greatly, and still does. But what's the long-term effect is that this absence that Mike has in my life, even though we may not have been that close, he was still my brother, he was still my gay brother, and that absence of not having him around is that which lingers with me. Certainly the suicide I still remember, but it's that absence that is the heaviest thing to carry. And I think probably for a lot of people who lose loved ones, it's the absence that is the long-term pain.
So in the grieving process, are you grieving, I assume the answer is both, but are you grieving for the life of your brother or the opportunities that you did not have that perhaps you should have?
It is absolutely both of them, but I would say it's the latter. It is those opportunities that I did not have with him, but also these opportunities that Mike did not have. Someone once told me that, the greatest sort of antidote to someone who's suicidal is to say that you have to think about unexpected wonder. In your life, you don't know what's coming. And when you commit suicide, that's it. There's no coming back. So what I really kind of sad about is all the unexpected wonders that Mike didn't get to experience that I have experienced over the last, I'm 55 years old now, so the last 55 years.
I apologize for the dark nature of this question, and you can certainly spurn it if you wish. I do wonder, though, in as you say, that at the beginning you were exploring this question of why he took his life and why you survived.
Right.
And yet, did you have to examine that you had indeed survived, that wasn't a thought that you ever had or a feeling that ever crossed your mind or will not in the future?
Well, I have a history of suicide attempts when I was in my teens, in my 20s. I had a very, very difficult childhood and a very difficult adolescence. So my suicide attempts were more of what many of them are looking for attention, asking for help, and not being able to figure out how to get help. Mike's suicide attempt was very planned out, was something quite different than what mine were. But yeah, I think that there comes a time, and one of the other reasons I wrote this book is because Mike still lives with me. Quite literally, he lives as a memory in my brain, as a thing. And in those, when I come upon dark times in my life, in the past, his voice has, sort of nibbled at me. That is, why do you want to endure this? Why do you want to endure this? And so for writing this book, I was able also to kind of corral him into my memory and to get him out of my present day, to say, that's not an option for me. I think that's the other reason I wrote this book as well, to deal with my past and to deal with my present as well.
How aware were you of each other's sexuality? I mean, did you come out to each other?
This is a very interesting story that I talk about in the book. It's one of the documents that I use. When I was in my 20s, my brother and I had come out to ourselves, to each other, but we agreed not to come out to the family. And this gives you some indication of my relationship with my brother Mike. He decided, however, to write a letter to the family. He Xeroxed it, sent it to everyone, didn't tell me about this. He came out, and at the end of the letter, he wrote, P.S. Andy is too. And then he went on vacation. So when everyone got the letter, they all called me. Looking back, it's kind of a funny story.
Yeah.
At the time, it wasn't.
Not at all.
No, it wasn't. But so they all called me, so I had to sort of deal with people asking me, what is this letter? And this was typical of Mike. This was sort of defined our relationship. And he would do this constantly.
And you're writing about that. I found it interesting because, as you say, it was very like him, and yet you still had the trust to tell him in the first place.
I still had the trust, yeah, because I was a younger brother. He was my older brother, right? And he was my only other gay brother. So I had a sense that he understood, he must have understood, the difficulty I had going through that family and that time period. So I thought we might be able to have a kinship. So of course I trusted him. I assumed that we were bound together, and he didn't view our kinship the same way.
How did he view your failed suicide attempts, do you think?
He was, I think, I was going to say he saw them as sort of part of my failure. Because Mike was the golden child of our family. He was the straight-A student, went to University of Notre Dame, Duke Law School, was a Wall Street lawyer. I was not. I was a B student, a troubled kid. So I think he saw that as part of my flawed existence. But I talk about in the book as well, he used my suicide attempts to play a very nasty game with me. The last conversation I had with Mike before he died, he asked me point blank, if you were really going to kill yourself, how would you do it? And I told him, and that's how he did it. So he laid the last kind of act he gave me was this act of guilt. I know, of course, that he had planned the suicide out long before he had that played that little game with me. But that's a lot of guilt you have to carry around that I had to carry around and to reconcile in the end.
And as you say, you write about this, but. When you think about that, just the way that you describe it now as a game, I'm guessing it took you a long time to get to that point to label it that.
Absolutely. This is the reason why it's been 25 years before. I've written many versions of this book over the years, but it's really been 25 years until I could write this book, because I had the time to sort of put all these reactions, these emotions in context, and to look at them almost dispassionately.
Is that word dispassionate? I mean, how dispassionately do you feel now about it?
I've described it this way, that I still feel the kind of anger one feels when someone close commits suicide, the loss. I still feel those things. I feel them less sharply now, and I don't feel them all the time. I don't walk around my day and my work filled with pain and anger. But I certainly, when I think of Mike, when I write about him, when other memories are triggered, those feelings are very sharp still, but they have a kind of ease to them. The edges are not as sharp.
The word then that I will end with, I guess, is acceptance. And is there an idea in your mind that as your father ages, that you would accept him for what he is, even if he is not willing to accept you for who you are, in a way of just having some form of closure?
That's an excellent question. It's also the project I'm working on right now, a book I'm calling My Father's Body. And it is a book of reconciliation because I look like my father. I have the same mannerisms as my father. And as his body is decaying, as he's going towards death, the question for me is, can I find reconciliation by looking at those parts of me that I inherited from him? Can I accept in me those traits that he gave me? And I think that's the way I'm looking for reconciliation with him.
Do you ever feel that there are things that you still have to say to him before he leaves us?
Yes and no. I've spent so much of my adult life keeping a distance from that toxicity that I don't. I've come to a point that I don't think I can get anything out that I might want to. I think it's a near impossibility. Certainly, my father and I are on speaking terms. Certainly, I see him periodically, but he never fails to disappoint. And I recognize that, and I acknowledge that. But like with my brother Mike, who was not the greatest brother in the world, my father is not the greatest father in the world, but he is still my father, as Mike was still my brother.
In writing the book and now having it complete and working now and looking at your relationship with your father, how do you feel this particular book, this collection of personal essays, helps others and perhaps gives us some understanding into absence and suicide?
That's a great question. I had a reader read this book before it was published, and he was a middle-aged straight white guy. He identified himself as such. And his response really heartened me because he said, I know a lot of gay people, but I've never understood what they had to go through, especially my age, when they were children, and how they had to survive and what that was like. And he had a greater understanding and sympathy for that experience. So I was thrilled that someone could understand, you know, come to that understanding. But I also think it's important that this book talks out about suicide, and really, as a country, we have to talk about this epidemic. We have to start using the word suicide in conversations and helping people.
The name of the book is The Dark Eclipse: Reflections on Suicide and Absence. The book is published by Rutgers University Press. I thank you very much for sharing with us this morning and sharing these reflections.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
A great pleasure to have you on the program. A.W. Barnes is the author of The Dark Eclipse: Reflections on Suicide and Absence. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.